Nemoto presents theater for beginners. Carol Churchill, Form Experimentation. Narrated with Microsoft Azure using the Ava voice. Running time, approximately 19 minutes. London, 1982. The audience at the Royal Court Theater murmurs with anticipation as they open their programs to an unusual page, a dinner menu and biographies of characters who span centuries. Soon the lights dim, and on stage, an epic dinner party springs to life. Around a long, glittering table sit women from different times and places. There's Isabella Bird, a Victorian-era explorer in her proper jacket, Lady Nijo, a 13th-century Japanese courtesan-turned-nun, in a kimono, Pope Joan, the legendary female pope of the 9th century, in full pontifical robes, Patient Griselda, the obedient wife from medieval folklore, in peasant garb, and others including a brash waitress who is actually a character from Chaucer. Presiding among them is Marlene, a sharp-suited 1980s career woman who has apparently invited these ladies of history to celebrate her promotion at work. What follows in Top Girl's opening act is a theatrical feast. Wine is poured, stories are shared. The women talk over each other, interrupting and laughing, their dialogue overlapping like a real lively dinner, an innovation in scriptwriting, those overlapping lines marked by slashes in the text. They share tales of childbirth, loss, sacrifice, ambition. Pope Joan recounts how she concealed her female identity to rise in the church, only to be stoned to death when discovered. Lady Nijo recalls the heartbreak of giving up her children in the emperor's court. As the courses progress, the stories become more intimate and tragic, even as some of the women drunkenly giggle. Marlene listens, cheers, occasionally shares her own boasts of the modern successes women can achieve. By scene's end, Isabella Bird is slumped under the table drunk, Patient Griselda is quietly weeping, and Marlene toasts to their courage across time. The audience is dazzled. This is funny, moving, and unlike any play structure they've seen. At intermission, they buzz. All women on stage, and not a dull moment. Who wrote this? The answer, Carol Churchill, a playwright in her mid-40s who, after years of steadily inventive work, has just unleashed a masterpiece. And the play's not done surprising them. In the next act, Churchill will jump from that fantastical dinner to stark scenes of working-class life and family tension, peeling back the cost of Marlene's success and asking tough questions about feminism and class. But even without knowing that yet, the audience feels they are in the hands of a master storyteller who can bend theater form to her will. Carol Churchill's journey to this moment was one of quiet but fierce determination. Born in 1938, she grew up during and after World War II, experiencing the disruptions of that time. Her family even emigrated to Canada for a while when she was a child. She studied English at Oxford in the 1950s, a time when very few women were recognized playwrights. She started writing short plays at university, showing a talent for sharp dialogue and an interest in social issues even then. After school, she married, became a mother to three sons, and for a period focused on raising her family. But she kept writing radio plays for the BBC, television dramas, exploring themes of power, gender, and identity. In the 1970s, as the feminist movement was cresting, Churchill found her theatrical voice aligning with the times. She became the resident dramatist at the Royal Court, a hub for new writing, and also worked with progressive theater companies that used collective creation and improvisation. One group was Monstrous Regiment, a feminist theater collective, for whom she wrote Vinegar Tom, 1976, a play about 17th century which trials that was really about the oppression of women, complete with Brechtian folk songs. Another was Joint Stock Theater Company, known for its workshop process. With them, she developed Cloud Nine, 1979, a brilliantly daring play that examines colonialism and sexual liberation, where in the first act Victorian British colonials in Africa are played by actors of mismatched race slash gender to role, e.g., a white man plays a black servant, a man plays a five-year-old girl. satirizing rigid roles, and then act two jumps to 1979 London with the characters 25 years older, though a century has passed, exploring how much or little progress has been made. Cloud Nine was a breakthrough hit, showcasing Churchill's hallmark, experimental form with purpose, humor, and emotional depth. By the time Top Girls premiered in 1982, Churchill had honed a unique style. She wasn't interested in linear realism. She bent time, made the invisible visible, like ghostly dinner guests, and played with language. She could mimic old dialects or modern corporate jargon with equal skill. Yet her plays were far from abstract intellectual exercises. They were engaging and often very funny, even as they critiqued society's structures, particularly patriarchy and capitalism. What set Churchill apart, too, was her commitment to collaboration and process. For Cloud Nine and other plays, she often used the joint stock method. The company would research a theme, like sexual politics, share personal stories, improvise scenes, and Churchill would synthesize the material into a script. She valued actors' contributions and believed theater was a collective art, which aligned with her left-wing political beliefs. However, unlike some collective-created work that ends up shapeless, Churchill's authorial voice and dramaturgical brilliance shaped the material into taut, surprising narratives. Carol Churchill's writing is also marked by constant reinvention. Once she's done something, she rarely repeats herself. After Top Girls, which became one of the most celebrated plays about women's roles in society, she tackled the greed of the 80s in Serious Money, 1987, a satire about stock market corruption written largely in rhyming couplets like a restoration comedy. Then she pivoted to dreamlike minimalism in The Skryker, 1994, blending folklore and a modern tale of two women in a nightmarish underworld. In the 2000s, she got even more formally daring. A Number, 2002, dealt with human cloning in a tight one-hour play for two actors, a father and his various clone sons, all played by one actor opposite the father, examining identity and parental guilt. Love and Information, 2012, was a collage of 50 microscenes with over 100 characters, none repeated, showing snapshots of how people seek meaning in an age overloaded with data and disconnection, a puzzle of a play that directors and actors could assemble in various ways. Through all these transformations, a few core Churchill traits remain: an interest in power dynamics, whether between genders, classes, or clones and originals, an empathy for those marginalized or hurting, a sly sense of humor, and an unflagging curiosity about theatrical form. She once said she's bored by the idea that plays must be one thing or another. She delights in finding the play's unique shape for its content. Imagine Carol Churchill in her writing room. It's simple, perhaps a desk by a window overlooking a garden. She's known to be a very private person, shunning interviews and publicity, so one pictures her in a quiet, secluded space. She has notebooks and index cards spread out. Four Top Girls, maybe she has history books on notable women, notes from workshops with the actors about their own ambitions and sacrifices, and an outline that is unconventional. Act 1, the dinner party, women from history meet. Act 2, employment agency scenes. Act 3, confrontation between sisters. She writes dialogue not in neat linear order, but almost like composing music. Some scenes overlap, some break off abruptly, some echo phrases. She's thinking about how to shift the audience's sympathies. In Top Girls, we admire Marlene for breaking the glass ceiling. Then we learn she abandoned her working-class roots, and even a child to do so, and our admiration complicates. Churchill doesn't spoon-feed these judgments. She sets up the situations and trusts viewers to engage with the complexity. At rehearsal, Churchill is likely soft-spoken but firm about what she wants. Actresses trying to master the overlapping lines of the dinner party might be frustrated at first, talking over each other without resolution. Churchill encourages them. Don't worry about being heard perfectly. It's the cacophony that matters. the feeling of all these voices clamoring for space. The audience will catch what they catch, and that's okay. It'll feel more real. For the quieter, emotional scenes later, she has keen insight into subtext. In Top Girls, a crucial later scene is between Marlene and her sister Joyce in Joyce's modest kitchen. There, we learn Joyce raised Marlene's daughter as her own so Marlene could pursue a career. It's a heartbreaking clash, the stay-at-home, burdened sister versus the jet-setting executive. Churchill directs the actresses to not play the melodrama, but the years of resentment through small jabs and attempts at politeness that unravel. Thus, when Joyce finally bursts out that she wasn't lucky, like Marlene, it cuts like a knife because we've felt the tension accumulate. Churchill's work often has a feminist lens, but she's never one to paint simple heroes or villains. She challenges the idea that a feminist success like Marlene can be celebrated without acknowledging who is left behind, the child, the sister stuck in poverty, etc. She examines intersectionality before that word was widely used, how class and gender intersect, for instance. And she also ventures into territory of the spirit and myth. She recognized that to understand human reality, you sometimes need to use unreality or non-literal elements, like ghosts or mythical figures or surreal leaps. One of the striking aspects of reading or watching her plays is how they're simultaneously intellectual and visceral. She engages your brain with structure and ideas, but she also hits your heart with raw moments. In Cloud Nine, after all the clever cross-casting and time jump, the play ends with a character from 1900 finally accepting herself in 1980 by embracing her younger self, an oddly touching resolution that brings many to tears as the two versions of the woman, played by two different actors, one from each act, hug on stage. In a number, after all the cerebral debate about cloning, the final scene quietly shows a father meeting a son who never knew him, and they awkwardly bond over banal conversation, underscoring the aching human need for connection beneath the science fiction premise. Carol Churchill's influence on theater is enormous. She showed that experimentation isn't at odds with emotional engagement or political commitment, especially for women playwrights. She broke barriers not just in content, but in form, proving they could be innovators, not only storytellers. Many contemporary plays with fractured structure, time leaps, or bold use of fantasy owe a debt to her pioneering work. A few years after Top Girls, a young theater student might think to themselves after reading it, "I didn't know you were allowed to do that," meaning create a play where so much is unconventional, a diner party with people from different centuries, an act that moves backwards in time, and yet works brilliantly. Churchill opens up possibilities. Now in her 80s, Carol Churchill remains active. She keeps writing short, punchy plays that experiment further. Recently, she's done very short plays. One, Seven Jewish Children in 2009, courted controversy with its political commentary on Israel. Another, Escaped Alone in 2016, combined cozy chats of old women with apocalyptic monologues. She never repeats herself, which is astounding over a career spanning six decades. Let's go back to that royal court in 1982, to the final moments of Top Girls. In the last scene, Marlene visits Joyce after a long time away, and they rake over the past. Joyce, the sister, has this blistering speech where she says she's glad life didn't turn out 50 million women got jobs under the right-wing government Marlene admires, because for her it only meant hardship. "I spit when I see a Rolls Royce, scratch it with my ring." Marlene, taken aback, lashes out that if Joyce is jealous of her fancy job, she's one of the top girls now. It's only because Joyce didn't take control of her life. Joyce explodes. "Who's to say I didn't? I had to mind the baby, didn't I?" And in that moment, the secret is out. The baby Marlene had at 17, whom Joyce raised. Marlene's bravado crumbles and she whispers, "I do think of her. Frequently." The sisters reach a fragile, painful standstill. Joyce goes to bed, leaving Marlene alone with a drink. Marlene's young niece, actually her daughter, comes in, half asleep, and in her innocence, she says she had a nightmare. "We were frightened," the girl says. "So, I told Mom, and we chased them, we killed them, we won." Marlene, tears in her eyes, just replies softly, "Frightening." The girl asks, "Do you have to go back?" meaning to London. "Yes, love, I do," Marlene says. The girl returns to bed. Marlene sits alone. The play ends not in triumph, but in ambiguity, a sense of gains and losses weighed, and an uncertain future for the next generation. As the lights fade, the audience sits quietly, digesting it all, the glorious, inspiring stories of women through time, and the sobering reminder of the real socioeconomic forces that still trap many women. They applaud, and as they depart, they debate. Was Marlene right or Joyce? Is it a feminist play or an anti-capitalist play or both? I loved the dinner party, but that fight between the sisters, that hit hard. They might not agree, but they all feel they saw something rich and thought-provoking. Carol Churchill has left them with no easy answers, but with a mind expanded to new possibilities of what theater can do. Her plays don't tell you what to think. They invite you to see patterns across history, across personal lives and public systems, and to ask, what now? With her mastery of form, she navigates you through complex ideas in a way that feels like discovery rather than lecture. For a beginner to theater, encountering Churchill is a revelation. She shows that theater is a living, flexible art form limited only by imagination. You don't have to follow rules of realism or chronology. You can sculpt time, space, and language to get to deeper truths. And underlying it, you sense her humane heartbeat. She cares deeply about people, especially those dealt a tough hand by society, and she cares about fairness and change. As Carol Churchill's season ends in our podcast, one thing stands out across all these episodes. Wilson, Mahler, Skechner, Nutschkein, The Living Theater, Kane, Churchill, each of these figures revolutionized theater by breaking boundaries. In Churchill's case, the boundaries were narrative and gender roles and the invisible structures of power. She invites us all, audience, writers, actors, to break a few boundaries ourselves, to experiment with how stories are told and whose stories get told, and in doing so, to perhaps imagine a more just and joyous world. Thus, we leave you with an image of Churchill not center stage. She avoids the limelight personally, but in the wings, watching one of her plays in performance, a slight smile on her face as an audience gasps or laughs at a moment she penned. Her satisfaction comes not from being seen as the genius, she's too modest for that, but from seeing the impact of the work. Then, as the applause sounds, she's already turning quietly to slip out and get back to writing, because for Carol Churchill, the journey of pushing theater's limits never really ends. Each play is a new adventure, and as long as she has ideas, she'll keep charting unknown territory, inviting us to follow and find our own meaning in the wild, wide-open landscape of a stage.